movies and booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
Enjoy alcohol sensibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.
Remaining as fresh and evergreen as ever, we are joined by Esther McCarthy, Leslie Williams and Fionnuala Jones. Good afternoon to you all.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Sean.
You clearly
haven't seen my most recent haircut.
Yes, it's all imaginary now at this point, anyway, I would have thought. So, Leslie, what are we going to be talking about today?
So, Bordeaux versus California, as remembered in that movie Bottle Shock, which I'm sure Esther might remember. Have a quick Google if you don't remember it, Esther. We might talk about that later.
That movie called what?
Bottle Shock. It was an Alan Rickman movie from 2008, which was the true story of how, in a blind tasting, Californian wines beat the pants off Bordeaux to the shock of the world. And the man who did that died recently, so I thought we'd mark that.
Right.
It's a good movie. Yeah, it's on Apple TV. I checked. It's $3.99 to rent it.
Okay, yeah, and that rings a vague bell. Did this take, the kind of blind tasting took place in Paris?
Yeah, it was the Judgment of Paris, it became known as. And it was the 200th anniversary of the war of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And he was an Englishman based in Paris, in Place de la Madeleine, and he had a wine shop. And as he spoke English, there was lots of Americans would drop in. So he kind of just thought, well, sure, maybe we'll do a tasting to mark the thing. And California wines are meant to be getting a bit better. And anyway, they had this blind tasting, and only French tasters. And to everyone's disgust at the tasting, the first white wine that came in first was the Chateau Montelena, an Irish-owned, part Irish-American-owned Chardonnay, and that beat all the nice Burgundy, white Burgundies.
And then later
they thought, this won't happen with the reds. After lunch, we'll fix them with the reds. But of course, in the end, it was a red from California that won in the second round. So. Anyway, I'll tell you more in a minute.
Yeah, and the California, now obviously the French one is a Bordeaux. Is the Californian one called Frog's Lead or Frog's Head?
Frog's Leap.
Right, Frog's Leap. Right, okay, that
Frog's
makes...
Leap. Sorry, my terrible writing on your little...
That makes more sense there now. I was wondering what the hell it was. Right, and so the two movies today, Esther?
Yeah, they're two potentially interesting ones. One works better than the other, though. Silk Road is a brilliant story, clumsily told, I think. It's about the kind of... It's this guy, by an American guy by the name of Ross Ulbricht. I don't know if you remember his story, but he set up a dark web website called Silk Road back in the early noughties. And, you know, he set it up to kind of, you know, deal a few drugs with his mates and stuff. But it quickly became one of the biggest organized crime dark websites in the world and put him on the radar of some very powerful people. But I think what this shows is it's hard to make sentences about things like Bitcoin work cinematically. I think that's the problem here.
Right, okay. We had a guy on earlier who was talking about Bitcoin. He was recording his own farts. They missed a trick there in terms of explaining what it's all about. Oh, well, that's interesting. Just based on what you say, it seems like they're depicting the fellow who set up Silk Road as, he was innocent in his intentions.
Totally. Like, that's the maddest thing about it. It doesn't take a point of view, this film. Or if it does, it's actually sympathetic to Ross Ulbricht, the guy involved, who is even played by that very charismatic actor, Nick Robinson, who had a big hit in his hands last year with Love, Simon. But it just doesn't... I wasn't buying it, you know?
Yeah. And A Town of Strangers.
This is an interesting one, actually. It's set in not far from your... original home place in Gort in County Galway, and it's set around the various characters in the town. It's a documentary, quite observational in style, by a filmmaker by the name of Trasa O'Brien. She kind of originally, I think, wanted to make a fictional movie in the town, and you know, she started auditioning and casting people who came into the town hall one day and decided they were all telling her their stories, their life stories and stuff, because that's what she wanted for the casting process. And she was going, actually, I'm not making a work of fiction out of this. These people are too colourful and too interesting and have too many stories to tell. So she's kind of set, and it's a lovely title for a film, I think, and really sums up what she's trying to achieve here. All these people from all over the world who live in this town, but are a lot of them are isolated in various ways, you know. So you get to meet, like, New Age hippies from England, members of the travelling community, Muslim asylum seekers, Brazilians, of course. You couldn't do a documentary on GERT without, I can't pronounce it properly, it's GERT, isn't it? Without having Brazilian characters involved. So that, it's a really interesting documentary, and I think it succeeds on the stories of the people who are in it.
Right, okay. One texter says, I can't believe White Tiger didn't get nominated for a Best Film Oscar. I thought it was way better than Mank, The Trial of Chicago 7 and Judas and the Black Messiah. What did Esther think of the nominations?
I thought, you know what the worst thing about this year is? Well, it's not the worst thing, but if you're a movie person, this would be prime arguing time for us. You know, everyone should be bickering with me on air and I should be giving my opinion. But even I haven't seen the majority of the Best Picture nominees this year. Now, I'm going to write that tonight. I have a double bill I'm really, really looking forward to, which is Nomadland, Chloe Zhao's film, and Minari, which is apparently a really good Korean-American film about a family, a Korean family who make a new home for themselves in the States. I have only heard good things about them. But I haven't seen Mank, which is my bad, because that's been available for a couple of months now. But I'm going to write that this weekend as well. Other than that, The Father, I haven't seen, hearing great buzz. I think the pedigree of what's in there is pretty good. I loved White Tiger as well, as you know, but I mean, the funniest thing of it all for me was the Oscar nominees having two directors with Chloe Zhao and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, as if this was a great thing, because, you know, the actual fact of a double female director nominee this year was that it multiplied the female director nominees in Oscar history by 40%. Huh. You know, the two this week bring to a grand sum total of 7 female Oscar nominees in the history of the Academy Awards.
My God, that tells its own stories. Fionnuala, yep. did you have any opinions on the Oscar nominations?
I did think it was surprising that Mank got so many. I just didn't... That is not one that I ever want to revisit, I think. I loved White Tiger as well and was surprised that it was kind of shut out. I thought everything else seemed pretty standard. I'm just kind of hoping Minari sweeps everything, because my God, what a film. What a joy of a movie. And just, I need that little kid that's in the cast to do, I need him to get every bit of promo, because he is, his reactions to everything, he's just incredible. His name escapes me at the minute, but that's what I'm hoping for anyway.
Yeah, and Mank was manky. Not great.
Yes, indeed. Yes. No, just,
surprising I don't so think many I'm nominees. An audience, though.
But the Oscars won't be a Zoom based event this year, Fionnuala.
No, so the organisers sent out a letter to nominees this week basically saying that if you're not there, tough luck, there will be no Zooms. I think it's in an effort to kind of address the flagging ratings that the award ceremonies have been getting. Obviously the Grammys happened earlier this week to, I'm not sure if it was an all-time low, but like very, very, very low viewership. And they've basically said it's going to be an intimate in-person ceremony. Attendees will have to complete a COVID test, obviously, and be negative, obviously. And with only those nominated, their guests and presenters in attendance. And they've also said that in terms of dress code, they've told nominees to avoid casual attire. I'm not sure if that's a dig at Jason Sudeikis at the Golden Globes in his hoodie, perhaps. But they've said they kind of want to go for this aspirational, inspirational, as normal as possible event. It's taking place at Union Station in downtown Los Angeles. And then there's other elements taking place at the show's traditional venue, which is the Dolby Theatre in Hollywood. So one to watch, I think. It'll be interesting to see how they do it.
Yeah, because it might still look a bit sad, though, if it's like 25 people in a massive venue.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. When you don't have those bums in seats, it's still a bit... you are going to lose something there in terms of atmosphere, but I am glad there's no Zooms, because that's, I found that so strange about the Golden Globes even to watch. Yeah. It was just, and the tech issues that came with it, it was nightmarish. It was like, oh, I can't even think about it.
Yeah, I'd like to thank, who are you thanking again? We didn't got you. Oh God, yeah, all right, it's the same as all of them. Have you deleted your Twitter account, by the way, or have you been banned off the platform?
Oh, I wish I'd been banned. No, I need social media cleanse. I'm still on all the other ones. It's just Twitter. I'm taking a brief hiatus because I'm bougie like that.
Yeah, okay. Because when I went to put you in the thing that I normally do, you weren't there. So I didn't know what happened. We thought you were dead briefly.
So, just in hiding.
So it's good to know you're just in hiding. Actually, on the same subject, Claire says Mank was really self-indulgent. When are movie makers going to realise that the rest of us don't care about movies, about other movies? Colin says, is the White Tiger thing just simply down to the fact that it is an Indian film? A lot of people liked it. I can't believe White Tiger didn't get nominated for a Best Film Oscar. I thought it was way better than Mank, the Trial of the Chicago 7 and Judas and the Black Messiah. What did... I've read that one out already. Right, Leslie, as you said... that chap who was featured in that film died just recently. I see there's Joan Dundalk, was his obit was in the Financial Times.
It was. Stephen Spurrier was his name.
Which side of the Atlantic are we going to start at?
No, we're starting with Bordeaux. So go with the, I think it's just the smaller bottle of the two that I gave you. Mm-hmm. It should have number one written on it. Chateau Le Conseiller, I think that. Conseiller? It means counsellor. C-O-N-S-E-I-L-L-E-R, I think it does anyway. Both the wines tonight are from Whelan's wines out in Loughlinstown, which is a good website if anyone needs to buy them online. The reason I chose them is because it was in Whelan's that I met Stephen Spurrier the last time. I'd met him once briefly before, but it was only in passing. But this time I actually had dinner with him along with a bunch of other wine writers, and we recreated the California versus Bordeaux tasting upstairs in the tasting room in Whelan's out in Loughlinstown. This would have been sort of May or June, I'd say, of 2018. And so it was really surprising that he died, because he was quite young. I mean, he was not young, but he was probably in his late 70s, but he certainly had a youthful mean about him. You know what I mean? He didn't seem in any way like he was about to be popping off anywhere. But I've been reading him for as long as I've been reading about wines. He had a regular column in Decanter magazine for generations, like literally since the 70s, I think, probably he would have started there. He was left a few million quid back when he was about 22, and he invested in various things like nightclubs in Barbados and things like this, as most 22-year-olds would. But eventually, in his 30s, he decided to open a wine shop in Paris. And as I was saying, he just decided to basically do a tasting, and to much to the surprise of everyone, he knew the California wines would do well, but didn't expect them to actually win out. So the one that won out was actually Stag's Leap. Now, obviously, the Bordeaux that I presented are not anywhere in the same league as this, but this, I think, is great. It's a €25 wine. Now, it's a Bordeaux Superior, generally not a part of Bordeaux that you find the finest wines, but this has got a really well-known producer, Jean-Philippe Janoux. And he basically makes wines in Pomerol and Saint-Emilion and so on. And he just makes really fruit-forward wines. Now, I was amused when I looked it up online to see what other people had thought they were saying. Oh, great value, Bordeaux. So at 25, it's not great value, but it is worth the €25 in terms of price for quality, I think. The Bordeaux Superior allows you to make it pretty much anywhere in Bordeaux, as opposed to making it in a specific village, like, say, the village of Margaux or the village of Pauillac or the village of say, Saint-Julien or something. So it's a more generic appellation. So often you get rather simple wines. But having said that, it can be a source of really good value, Bordeaux Superior. So what I liked about this was a little bit of age. It's 2015, by the way. Someone was asking a week or two ago about 2015. And yeah, it was a really warm year in France. So 2015 Bordeaux's are worth buying. If you see a 2015 versus a 2018 or something of the same wine, I tend to go with a 15. So it's just got really kind of creamy, soft, blackcurranty fruits, sort of chocolate touches and so on, kind of blackcurrants and blackberries. Have you had a taste? Did you get a taste?
Yeah, it was it's delicious. I love a Bordeaux.
Yeah. So and look, Bordeaux makes about 650 million bottles of wine a year, right? And so this tasting was only between the top, you know, sort of 10 and the top 10 of California. So obviously those wines still cost a fortune. But with 650 million bottles being made every year, there's a hell of a lot of recent really drinkable wines under 20 and so on. So I'm not knocking Bordeaux, but it is interesting that California wine, well, we'll see with the California wine in a little while, because it's twice the price of this, but it's still half the price of the equivalent in quality from Bordeaux, I would say.
Yeah, and interesting though, you say, for instance, like if Margaux has to be called Margaux, is that kind of an effort? And Margaux tends to be more expensive, as people probably know, but is that also an attempt to distance itself from Bordeaux, which is kind of a mass market wine, really?
It is. I mean, there's plenty of winemakers in Bordeaux who should be growing potatoes rather than grapes, you know. But that's okay. Look, that's their tradition. They've been doing it for a long time. And the whole French system is all based around geography. So if you take you know, Dublin city centre as an Appalachian, the lads who live on George Street will claim that their wine is the best, and maybe over years it will be proven to be the best. So they'll be given their separate, own separate Appalachian. So Margaux was given its own separate Appalachian because all the wines were supposedly taste the same from the same terroir. Margaux is said to smell and taste of violets, for example. Whereas the wines of Saint-Estèphe are where there's a bit more clay in the soil. There's a different structure of the wines there. They tend to be a bit earthier, a bit darker, a bit more rustic and so on. And you know, you can grow Merlot better there, for example. So often there's a bit more Merlot there. So it's things like this. It's they figured out the best way to do things in these villages organically. And then when the authorities came in from the 30s to the 60s, working out what we should call every wine, certain villages were considered better and were and already had fame. So they allowed them to put that name on the label, and then they codified it in law. So anything in Margaux is made for Margaux. But you also get plenty of rather mediocre Margaux because they're on the edge. And they're just barely in the Appalachian, and they couldn't be bothered making much effort. So, but they're charging twice as much because it says Margaux on the label.
Yeah.
So this,
yeah,
instance for Bordeaux Superieur is a really good winemaker with supposedly less good land, but he's doing a phenomenal job.
Okay, yes, I've had some of that Margaux you've just described. Yeah. Esther, should we do Silk Road first?
Yeah, I think so. Let's do Silk Road.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Silk Road coming up after this break.
Is this? You don't know me, but I have your next story.
30 seconds.
Making small talk with your pot dealer sucks. Buying cocaine can get you shot, but what if you could buy drugs online like socks or light bulbs?
Now you can, with an online website called Silk Road. Did you coach him on this?
Who am I talking with?
Call me Mark. No last name, but you can quote me.
And you created it?
No, but I ordered 10 hits of acid delivered to my doorstep by the U.S. Postal Service.
And what did that feel like?
Well, to tell you the truth, Adrian, kind of felt like the future.
There you go. That's Silk Road, based, of course, on a true story. So, Esther, what's the essential premise?
Yeah, in 2011, a young American librarian who frankly should have stuck to the day job, named Ross Ulbricht, set up this darknet website called Silk Road. And he used different things, including he used Bitcoin as a form of payment and Tor for anonymity. Not Tor, the Marvel superhero, yeah, the guy without the H. And the site facilitated the sale of drugs by post, which was the gas, kind of gas thing about it. You know, they thought it was very funny altogether that we're getting away with doing this. And he traded, there's a lot of eccentric elements to this. Like, he traded under the name Dread Pirate Roberts, who fans of The Princess Bride will know is a character in that book and movie. But he was basically about to get in way, way over his head, because the website kind of rapidly became a multi-million dollar pipeline for illegal drugs. And the FBI became kind of determined to bring him down. So he's played by Nick Robinson in the film. And it takes a very kind of bizarre viewpoint here, because at best, you know, even if you're very, very sympathetic to this young man, like, at best, he's a bit of an idiot. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But at worst, he is like, he set up this whole empire for illegal activity, was even like, you know, even tried to get hits on people who were at risk of exposing him at one stage, and managed to argue in court that none of the hits came through, therefore it shouldn't be taken seriously. And so he's kind of going like, really, I'm supposed to empathize with this guy? Now, they did throw the book at him, like, he got double life and 40 years. And I think a lot of the campaigning around that is to have him pardoned. Even Donald Trump refused to do a presidential pardon, though, before leaving office. So it's right, like, I couldn't get on board with this as treating him as a sympathetic character at all.
Yeah, because it wasn't just like pot, a bit of pot that was being, like, it was massive drug deals, it was guns, it was paedophiles. Like, every scumbag you could think of is on Silk Road.
I mean, what next? Like, Mark Zuckerberg, a love story? You know, yeah, it's a strange...
or comedy.
Yeah, with our sympathetic hero. So it's a strange kind of angle that they take in this, I guess. But certainly not the only problem with the film. It's written and directed by a guy by the name of Tyler Russell, who has a good action pedigree both in filmmaking and kind of... kind of real life crime stuff, but it's the problem with this, I think, and I kept thinking, going back to the social network, and we've slagged off Aaron Sorkin here many times over the years, and but he and David Fincher really made a masterclass in how to make a movie about the internet sexy on screen. True great dialogue. We didn't know at the time that was going to become, that dialogue was going to become so dialed up in a lot of Sorkin's work. But I think when you saw The Social Network originally, it was a really great film. And that, I think, is the problem here. I didn't know what was going on half the time. There is a lot to take in. There is, like, I've read up on it since, and there is a brilliant story in there somewhere. But I think it needed, both tonally and in its storytelling, it needed a lot of tightening up before it got to screen, you know, because they had a good source story as well. It was based on a Rolling Stone long read that was published about the case years ago. I got on a bit better with Jason Clarke's character. He's just more sympathetic and played by a great Australian actor anyway. He's just really always good in everything he does. He's playing the guy, a guy by the name of, another real life character by the name of Rick Bowden. So he's the DEA agent who's an old school cop. He wants to use traditional methods to track down Ulbricht, much to the mirth of the younger and more tech savvy team into which he's been parachuted after being demoted. He has a history of alcoholism as well, so there's a lot going on with his character. He kind of comes obsessed though, and ends up implicating himself. He ended up doing time himself for some of his actions. But he's the better character for me. But the idea that Ulbricht's crimes weren't victimless and that, you know, a geek who was raking in millions, they kind of present him, which has been done before, but like he was a geek that was raking millions, but he was actually presented as some sort of an online freedom fighter who was pushing for a world without boundaries. No, dude, you were pushing for a few bob off drugs, you know, at the very least. So I never bought into that, and that's never solidly or convincingly sold in the screenwriting. So it's a pity. There's a good story in here waiting to happen. I kind of didn't care, you know.
Somebody's texting and saying that there is a documentary also called Silk Road, Drugs, Death and the Dark Web.
It's really good.
Which Barry says is pretty good. I was wondering this myself. Aaron wants to know, really want to watch Nomadland. Where's the best place to find it? Or is it available yet even?
So Nomadland is probably most likely the front runner for Best Picture this year. So we've all been watching going, when are we going to see it? I'm delighted to say I'm going to see it tonight. I'm lucky. But what is happening with it is it's getting released onto Disney Plus at no extra charge from 30th of April, if I remember. I think it's late April. And as soon as the cinemas open, it's going to theatrical release. So I think this is something very, very special. And if you want to see it in the big screen, hopefully Disney will ensure that you get to do so in the summer.
Still, though, it's a long wait for this side of the Atlantic.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's the end of April we're getting it here. I mean, the cinemas have been closed so long here now. There's just, as I say, like so many Oscar nominees that I haven't even had the opportunity to see yet, you know.
Yeah. Sinead wants to know, are we inevitably facing into an Elon Musk movie?
Oh, God, I hope not. Only if it's a musical, I don't even bear it otherwise.
Could you imagine? Though somebody else says, there's a lot of opinions in this text. All eponymously named biopics are terrible, including Lincoln, by the way, and Daniel Day-Lewis, who is a ham with one great performance in The Age of Innocence. 3 Oscars, yeah. Spencer Tracy, too. Totally forgotten today because he was a ham also. So there's somebody who doesn't like anyone. It would take too long to answer all those points. I don't think we have enough time left in the show. A few questions for you, Leslie. Can you ask your wine guru, I have a bottle of red wine, Chateau Marquet, it's Marquet 2001. Is it still drinkable or worth anything?
That should be okay. Yeah. I don't think it's worth anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, 2001 was a decent enough year, and it should have lasted well. If it's the one I'm thinking of, it's Bordeaux, I'm assuming. If it's the one I'm thinking of, 2001. It wasn't as good as 2000, but you know, like it was a decent vintage, and you know, most Bordeaux wines will last at least. Well, look, it's pushing it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, open it quick.
Would Leslie be able to recommend a good Vernacia that I could find in and around the South Dublin area?
Vernaccia di San Gimignano. So that's a Tuscan white wine, Vernaccia being the grape. Any decent wine shop would have that. Redmond's and Rana would have one. You'll struggle to find that in the supermarkets. There's probably one in O'Brien's. I can't think of one off the top of my head. So Vernaccia has grown in a couple of places, but Vernaccia di San Gimignano is the most famous one. Decent wine shops. I'm trying to think, like Devaney's in Dundrum, I'd say would definitely have one. Anybody with a decent Italian section, Corkscrew in Dublin City Centre would definitely have one. Best of Italy might have one. They're Italian specialists.
That's a few to try there. And Sarah wants to know, can I use an old champagne as a cooking wine or would that taste weird?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I got kind of equal praise and condemnation about this time last year because I was sent, there's no in-person tastings anymore. But they wanted to present the new vintage of Dom Perignon. So I had to open it because it was a Zoom tasting and they were watching me. So I couldn't just pretend I hadn't opened it. And then I cooked some fish later that night and sloshed a load of it into the sauce. And people were going, oh my God, how much? That's 27 euros worth of, or 30 euros worth of wine you put into your sauce for your fish. But sure, look, that's what it was for. It was great. So absolutely. Now, if it's a little oxidized, that won't be good for everything. Maybe not for fish sauce, but I've... oxidized wine is perfectly fine for cooking in, maybe for slow roasting something in,
Okay, sounds lovely. And Fanula, Sharon Stone has a new autobiography out, The Beauty of Living Twice. And she's kind of given her version of what happened in that famous, stroke infamous scene in Basic Instinct. She's making out she was tricked into it.
Yeah, I never knew this. So as you said, this is her new memoir, The Beauty of Living Twice. Vanity Fair got an excerpt of it in which she says that a member of the production crew told her to take her underwear off during the scene under the pretense that like her private area wouldn't be seen because of the way the scene was lit. Mm-hmm. And then she found out when they all got called in to see the final finish of the movie.
Why did they want her to take off her pants in the first place?
She doesn't say... but I would assume it kind of, I think we'll come into it in the end in terms of her final decision about it. But when she came to see the final cut of the movie, she said the room was full of like agents and lawyers, lots of people who had nothing to do with the project. And she said that's when she saw the shot for the first time. She said she'd kind of been told repeatedly that you wouldn't be able to see it because of the light reflecting, whatever, blah, blah, blah. She said after the viewing, she slapped the director, Paul Verhoeven, left, went to her car, called her lawyer. His name's Marty Singer. He told her that the movie couldn't be made, according to the Screen Actors Guild, because of the way it was shot and the fact that it was shot up her dress. She went back, said it to the director that she had options. He was like, you don't have options. We've done this now, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And in the end, she ended up making the choice to let them use the scene and go ahead with it. She said she felt it was correct for the film in the end and for the character. And she said, after all, she did do it. But she kind of went on to say that the whole experience was very stressful. She said she slept walk on set a couple of times, mm-hmm. That's a hard word to say, and said she was plagued with really bad nightmares. So I think, to be honest, they clearly had some vision for the movie, as warped as that vision may have been, and they just wanted to go with this for the character. I still think it's absolutely disgraceful that it was this level of deception or whatever else, and I think it says a lot about the culture of filmmaking with women at the time and probably up to present day. I'd say that is going to be an absolute bombshell memoir. I can't wait to see what else comes out of that book, because she's seemingly being very, very honest about her experiences.
Oh yeah, they were making out that she had to take off her underwear because it was white and it would reflect the light.
Yeah.
Crikey. You'd wonder though, I mean, like, she said she had a choice, but maybe she kind of felt she, ultimately didn't have a choice. You'd kind of wonder though, it set the tone for her entire career. She became known for one scene.
Yeah, that's the thing. And it's one to consider, like, what would have happened had she not gone ahead with it or whatever. And as you said, she says that she had choices and she could have made a call on it. But like, when you're in that room and you're under that pressure, surrounded by people to make this movie and get it across the line no matter what, she probably felt like, God, is it actually worth the effort of me putting up my hand and being like, actually, this wasn't okay. I was told one thing. Sometimes I think I think people just make a call to be like, it's better not to rock the boat and just carry on with it.
Sure, yeah. You'd wonder though how her career might have been, or the trajectory of her career might have been different if that scene had never appeared in the film. Geez, a tough one to decide. Right, okay, we do have to take a break. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Coming up next, one more movie, one more wine. 53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cents. Leslie, Esther and Fionnuala are still with us. We have sampled one wine from Bordeaux, and we've talked about the film Silk Road. Plus, we've also talked about Sharon Stone's scene in I was going to say Fatal Attraction. And the infamous scene, Basic Instinct, that she says she was basically kind of fooled into taking part in. Orla says, I thought Basic Instinct was a bit of a horrible sleaze fest before I knew this. As much as I don't like cancel culture, it wouldn't harm any of us to have that one bite the dust, says Orla. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't a great film, but it was of its time. There were a lot of films from that period, like Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction were kind of like women are scary. There was a kind of a weird theme there. Angela says somebody else was texting in about Daniel Day-Lewis and being very critical of him. Has that person trashing Daniel Day-Lewis not seen Phantom Thread or Bad Day at Black Rock for that matter, says Angela? Perhaps not, or perhaps they did see them and they didn't enjoy them. Somebody else wants to know, Esther, they're trying to get on their hands in the film Wrestling Ernest Hemingway.
That's a great title,
isn't it? Yeah, I assume it's a movie rather than just a some sort of video game where you can wrestle Ernest Hemingway.
I don't know of it. You can look under. Guess what I'm about to say, Sean? JustWatched.com. Just Bleeding Watched, which I've been talking about last year. It's a great resource though for finding films and series, and also doing price comparisons on rental platforms. I wish it had a forward-thinking element. It'd be brilliant if you could find out what's coming out next week. But it is a really good resource. Just be sure and search under Ireland, or else you'll find out where Wrestling Ernest Hemingway is available in the United States.
And Noel says, I picked grapes for Chateau Margaux in 1981. Would love to get my hands on a bottle just to taste a wine. The grapes would have been through my hands. Do you think there's a chance of getting a bottle somewhere, says Noel?
Probably about €1,000.
There you go, Noel. There's your answer. It's always possible if you have the money.
81 is considered one of the lesser vintages of the 80s as well, because 82 was the famous one. Look, the good news is it'll be cheaper than 82 or 85 or 86 or most of the other years. I mean, so, and it should look, hey, good winemakers make good wines every year, so you never know.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about our second wine today, Frog's Leap.
Okay, so by the way, I wanted to just say one thing about wine tasting competitions. I don't like the idea, really. You know, you shouldn't be comparing one against another. I mean, just appreciate the wine on its own for what it is. But look, if you were going to do it, it's still a bit of fun to do it. The wine that won that year in that tasting was a wine called Stag's Leap. So one of the assistant winemakers of that wine was a guy called John Williams, who later founded his own winery called Frog's Leap. Hmm. And given that Stag's Leap was for a time the most famous California wine on the planet, I think it's no coincidence, I suspect, that he called his own wine Frog's Leap as opposed to Stag's Leap. But anyway, so he's John Williams is his name, no relation to me, sadly. There's something about Napa Cabernet. They're just so drinkable and so tasty, even from the first day they're bottled. Yeah, the really good ones, sadly, are expensive, but they're not horrendous. I mean, you know, talking, like, say, Ridge Montebello is probably the best available, and that's a couple of hundred. But a bottle of recent vintage Chateau Haut-Brion, which is one of the wines that was defeated in the tasting back in 76, that would cost you €999, pretty much. That's what O'Brien's were selling it for there recently when I was looking.
Wow.
I mean, that's just too much money. I just will not. Like Lynch Baz used to be £30 back in the day, back in the 90s. Now it's £250 a bottle, often at least £180. That's just an awful lot of money to be spending. This is £50, and I think just most people would actually probably prefer this to many of those Bordeaux wines. I just love the kind of silkiness of it, that kind of chocolatey Cabernet thing going on, sort of blackcurrants and the sort of the richness, but the elegance of it. It just slips down so nicely.
Right, that explains why you put it in a smaller bottle for the sample, you know.
Oh, that was apologies on
that. Oh, it's okay. No judgment there. I don't blame you at all for doing that. Right, we must well move on to our second movie of the day. Here's the clip.
People of Gort, we want to hear your stories, your dreams, your memories, lies and gossip.
I give you my peace, I give you my love, I give you my compassion, I give you my blessings.
I feel comfortable here. I feel very nervous moving out of the country.
And over the last few months I got involved with, there's four different men and a lot of visitors coming for the last 5 months. I just almost, when I go home now, it doesn't feel like home. It's like it's been invaded somehow.
Now when I came to court, I'm scared. If I go outside or something, work around, I'm scared. That's it. I don't want to say nothing else.
What are you scared of?
Scared of people.
That's a town of strangers there. That sounds quite dark, some of these stories, Esther.
Yeah, it's very moving. And there's a lot of there's a lot of vulnerable people here talking really honestly about their lives, I suppose. It's a good film, though. It is very, very moving in places. So it's Trasso O'Brien, and she, as I said, she originally planned to make a fictional movie, but maybe with the idea of people telling real stories through fiction. But she'd trained her lens on these people and said, tell us a story about yourself. And what came out of the mouths of these people was just way too interesting. And it's a resulting documentary. Now, there's a making of element that I wasn't mad about, about blurring the lines between drama and fiction, or documentary and fiction, which didn't really sing for me. But what I thought was fantastic about this is the subjects and the things they talk about. Like, there's a guy, there's quirky people in here as well. There's a guy called Ralph. He's a new age hippie from Northern England who left Ireland 17 years ago and told his girlfriend he'd be back in 3 weeks. And he says, do you think she's still waiting for me? And stuff like that. And then there's lovely Hamid from Afghanistan, who got off a truck in Dublin and said, where am I? And got shown to a refugee place, you know. So there's real truth in people's testimony here, I think. A lovely girl called Elam talking about missing Syria, missing having coffee in the morning with her mother and knowing that was our time, which is very sweet. And there's we have traveller character as well, a girl called by the name of Chloe. She's 18. And she talks about being the first traveller in her family to complete her leaving cert. Hasn't a notion of getting married, young, and, you know, just has plans for her own future. So I think what this does is, you know, Gort's a very, very diverse town, always has been a big immigrant town. And I think just this shines a little bit of a light into the corner of that. And it's a lovely film, I have to say. It is dark in places. People's stories and truths are hard. But I think it's a film about empathy. And I really liked it for that, especially at the moment, I have to say.
Yeah.
To get to hear people's stories, you know.
Is it just a series of interviews, or is there kind of an overarching narrative thread to it?
There is a kind of the narrative is kind of the making of, but that worked less successfully for me. But it does have a line in the sense that they are all set in this armchair surrounded by props in Gort's town hall. So they're, you know, it's quite good. The characters don't interact, but it works, you know, it works in the stories of people's lives. This one's available, I should say, first of all, Silk Road is available from Monday on various rental platforms. I forgot to mention that. And this one is on IFI at Home from tonight.
Right. OK. Well done for remembering that, because I forgot to ask you. Right. So finally, Fionnuala, we'll end things with a piece of some good news. Pete Davidson, people would know him from Saturday Night Live. He's married now and blissfully happy with his childhood sweetheart.
Perhaps not. Some people might have been following this story if they follow Demois on Instagram. It's like a celebrity gossip account. There were some questions sent in to them about Pete Davidson being married and kind of this strange press release that was released by this woman who claimed to have been married to him. She has since been arrested for trespassing at his home. Michelle Mootready, I think is her name. She was arrested Thursday following this Tuesday announcement of this fake nuptials that they had. It's all very, very strange. She'd released a statement basically saying that they'd set up this production company together and that they were childhood friends and that they were very happy to be married and had this fake quote from him as well saying, I'm really excited to be part of this production company and help people get a start in the career. But yeah, seemed to have been big stalker vibes, but she has since been arrested. She got into his house, as we said, but he was not at home at the time. So all good there. I'm sure that's a big relief to him, because you can imagine reading that in the news and knowing that it's not true. Mind-boggling, to say the least.
Yeah, because it must have been 24 hours where people thought he had got married and this was a real thing.
Oh, yeah. And especially, I think, because of his past dating history, like, this is a guy who was engaged to Ariana Grande. He's like very high profile. For this to kind of come out of nowhere, it started off as this kind of salacious, like, nice little bit of gossip for the week. And it actually took a bit more of a sinister turn. But thankfully now people are all in the right hands and he seems to be safe and happy and still single, ladies. So there you go. Shoot your shot.
Just goes to show you never get over your first love. Leslie, Esther and Fionnuala, thank you all very much. That's our lot for today.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
Enjoy alcohol sensibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.